I'm Paul Kennedy, and this is Ideas on How to Think About Science. Today, theoretical physicist Lee Smolin talks about string theory, the theory that matter is ultimately composed of tiny vibrating strings. It's a conjecture, he says, that now dominates his field, but can't be tested experimentally.
It's a puzzling and disappointing turn of events because there's not a consequence for experiment. Nobody's been able to extract anything that is what we call falsifiable. That is, if it's not seen, then the theory is wrong. And this has just never happened before in the history of physics. A remarkable thing. I mean, as radical as general relativity was, even before Einstein had it in final form, he knew what the key experiments were. He knew what he would have to match. Same thing with special relativity, same thing with quantum mechanics. Same thing in every successful instance in the history of physics. The experimental check comes right away. There's always the contact with nature. And this idea that some thousand very gifted, very highly placed people in the most elite places in the world passionately believe in something and have worked on it passionately for two decades without a hint of how to test it experimentally, that's unlike anything that's ever happened before in the history of physics.
Lee Smolin explores the unprecedented character of the string revolution, as it's called, in a book that he brought out in 2006. It's called The Trouble with Physics, The Rise of String Theory, The Fall of Science, and What Comes Next. And it's much more than just a complaint about string theory hogging the limelight in theoretical physics. The book also takes a wide-ranging look at the unresolved questions that have perplexed physics for the last century. And it makes a plea for a return to the more philosophically adventurous style that Smolin thinks characterized the physicists of the early 20th century. Lee Smolin is a member of the faculty of the Perimeter Institute at the University of Waterloo, and in today's program, he'll talk about the history of physics, about his own work, and about string theory. Here's Ideas producer David Cayley to introduce him.
The story of Lee Smolin's career in theoretical physics begins with a teenage encounter with the writings of Albert Einstein. It was the early 1970s. Smolin had dropped out of school in Cincinnati and was trying to start a company that would make geodesic domes, spherical structures framed on a network of triangles that were then much in vogue. He imagined elongating the basic structure in order to adapt it to various domestic uses, pool covers, say, or garages, and this required him to learn tensor calculus, the mathematics of curved surfaces. And that was how he discovered Einstein, as he told me during a conversation at his home in Toronto.
I went to the public library and got some books on tensor calculus, and I started to study them, and every book had a chapter on general relativity, because that was the mathematics that Einstein used to describe curved surfaces. So I started to study a little bit about general relativity. And I found it interesting. So I went back to the library and I got a book of essays about Einstein, which had one essay by Einstein, which was his autobiographical notes. It was the only thing he ever wrote that was autobiographical. So I was at a kind of personal crisis at that, a sort of high school angst personal crisis. So my girlfriend had split up with me and the band had fired me that I was in. And I was supposed to have a date with another girl, but she stood me up. And it was a sort of warm spring evening. So I sat down, I read that essay. And Einstein described why he went into science. And he had this vision that the world, human life, was sort of difficult and crummy, and by, I think this is a quote, or roughly, by the existence of a stomach, human beings are doomed to chase money and chase material things. But there's this great, beautiful, transcendental world out there, which is reality, which is space and time and matter, and they have this beautiful mathematics and truths that describe them, and you can transcend your little human life by somehow grasping some of this transcendental reality. And I was just hooked. I mean, it was exactly right for, you know, 17. And I just decided that evening that I would do that. And somehow I had this idea that I could do that. And I have no idea why, because I'd never taken a physics course. I had been refused entry into the physics courses at the high school because the physics teacher was a very right-wing guy, and I was this sort of left-wing student activist. And he had told me that he would refuse to let me into any of his courses. So I'd never taken physics at all, and I didn't know much about it, except I'd studied some of Einstein's theory of general relativity. But somehow I got the idea that I could do that. So in a way it was very simple. It was really just a few hours, and I had a kind of mission. And I've stuck true to that ever since. And somehow I have no idea why I guessed right.
One of the things that inspired Lee Smolin in Einstein's autobiographical notes was the essay's philosophical breadth. And this was a quality he eventually came to admire in the whole generation that created the new physics of the early 20th century.
My understanding of the history of 20th century physics is that there was a revolutionary period from the beginning of the century till the late 1920s, when physics was dominated by these great revolutionaries, Einstein, Bohr, Heisenberg, Schrödinger, and so forth. And these people had a certain style of doing physics, which was very oriented towards finding new foundations for physics and understanding the physics, rooted also in experiment very much, but also equally rooted in philosophy and the philosophical tradition. Einstein and these others knew the philosophical tradition very well. They were unembarrassed and unashamed to talk about, you know, Kant or Leibniz or Mach in their discussions with each other about physics, and also very independent. They disagreed with each other. For example, Einstein and Bohr famously disagreed over quantum mechanics, but they were friends. They enjoyed each other's company. They deeply respected each other. And there was also something very European, but very sort of founded in the style of the European Academy in them.
What these men debated about was the meaning of the discoveries they had made. The new science of quantum mechanics, for example, had created a number of puzzles. Light, which had been assumed to be either a particle or a wave, now appeared to be both at the same time. Separated particles were shown as still linked with one another, in ways that appeared to violate the principle that nothing can travel faster than the speed of light. And things at the quantum level seemed to assume a definite and determinate shape only when observed. At first, the philosophical implications of these findings were urgently discussed. But then, Lee Smolin says, these debates were set aside.
The style of physics changed strongly between the 1930s and the 1950s, and there were two reasons for that. One of them is that the center of physics changed because of World War II from Europe to the United States. And so a much more pragmatic American spirit arose and dominated physics. In much the same way, and I think there's an interesting analogy to be drawn out here, to the way that the abstract expressionists in New York in the 50s, you know, sort of stole the dominance of the future of art from Paris and Berlin and so forth. So that was one reason. Another reason is that quantum mechanics was in complete form. The older generation were fighting over whether they accepted it. There were philosophical issues, deep philosophical issues. Einstein, Bohr, Heisenberg, Schrödinger, you know, the generation that made quantum mechanics were continuing to debate and argue over its meaning, its philosophical implications. The younger generation were more pragmatic. They accepted it as given. They were tired of philosophy. They saw the older generation as wasting their time with all these endless philosophical arguments that got nowhere. They just wanted to take the theory and use it. And indeed, it was possible to use it to extend the domain of science to the properties of materials, atoms, molecules, nuclei, elementary particles, stars, galaxies. There was a huge range of things to be done with quantum physics. And so this new generation was, for both reasons, much more pragmatic. There was also, after World War II, funding from the governments became much more important, and science grew exponentially. The universities grew in this period after World War II. Science became much more a profession, much more an industry. And the older philosophical, foundational, individualistic style didn't fit as well. And indeed, when I was in graduate school and in the period after graduate school, I was educated as a particle physicist by the people who, you know, had been triumphant in the new style. They had made, before I went to graduate school, the Standard Model of Particle Physics, which is the reigning triumph of the pragmatic style. And my teachers in graduate school, I was very fortunate, were the people who made that, like Steve Weinberg, Shelley Glashow, Sidney Coleman, and so forth. And the sort of romantic sense that I had about what a scientist was, which came from Einstein, and my readings of Einstein and his fellow revolutionaries from that period, didn't really have a place in the world of science that I was introduced to in graduate school. Now, there were some remnants of that world at some smaller universities scattered throughout the world. They were called then the relativity community. They were sort of remnants, people who were, you know, students or associates of Einstein who had been able to establish a few footholds, a few research groups here and there. And eventually I got absorbed into that world because that was more, I fit better into it. But it was definitely a marginal world compared to the dominant style of science.
What Lee Smolin and the relativity community wanted to keep alive were the issues that had preoccupied Einstein. Some physicists, like Niels Bohr, had simply accepted the findings of quantum mechanics on the basis that our knowledge, in principle, can never be complete. But Einstein could not accept this limitation on knowledge. He believed that physics should be able to produce a complete picture of the physical foundations of our world. And consequently, Lee Smolin says, he ended up opposing what he himself had begun.
See, the paradox of Einstein is that he started everything in the 20th century. He is the dominant intellectual figure. Quantum mechanics goes back to, he was the first person who understood the need for quantum mechanics. The duality between waves and particles goes back to him. Photons go back to him, as well as special relativity, as well as general relativity. So 20th century physics is the consequence of his work, and at the same time he dissented from its form when it was finally coalesced into the current form of quantum mechanics based on quantum mechanics in the late 1920s. He dissented from it, and because he felt that and believed strongly that quantum mechanics, giving only statistical predictions, could not be a real theory. A real theory could tell you what was, must tell you what's happening in every individual process, not just give you statistical predictions. He had other reasons as well. Quantum mechanics doesn't give a picture of reality in the absence of our intervention, which he felt science was about. Science was about going to this transcendent viewpoint and seeing the world as if we were absent. And quantum mechanics does not do that. Quantum mechanics is a kind of code for describing the effect that we have on the world when we make controlled experiments. The mathematical pieces of quantum mechanics refer to our interventions, our measurements, and that was completely unacceptable for Einstein. On the other hand, for Bohr, who came out of a tradition, philosophically through Kierkegaard, Schopenhauer, and so forth. This was how science had to be. For Bohr, science was an extension of our interaction with the world and our conversation with each other about the world. So they had a profound disagreement. And finally, physics, as it was left by this pragmatic turn when the revolution was prematurely declared over, was left unwhole. There is quantum physics, which takes you from the most fundamental particles through solids, the properties of materials, three of the four forces we know about, but the fourth one, which it doesn't touch, is gravity. And gravity, according to Einstein's theory of general relativity, and we have good evidence for this, is an aspect of the geometry of space and time. So there's a deep issue about the nature of space and time, which is left unresolved, and could only be resolved by finally finding one theory which is describes nature as a whole, which incorporates both space and time and gravity, the cosmos on the large scale, and quantum physics, atoms, particles, and so forth. This is what we call sometimes the problem of quantum gravity. And this was unresolved. And for a long time was not very much worked on, except for a few individuals scattered from here to there. And indeed, that was the problem that I took on from Einstein, and that I then began to work on in undergraduate school and graduate school, and that I have worked on.
The problem of quantum gravity, on which Lee Smolin has worked, arises from the incompatibility between Einstein's theory of relativity and quantum mechanics. Relativity describes the geometry of space-time, of which gravity is an aspect. Quantum mechanics describes the fine structure of matter. But the two don't fit together. The key issue, Lee Smolin says, has to do with the nature of space and time.
The discussion really goes back to the time of Newton, and it goes back to debates between Newton and his followers and Leibniz and his followers. Now, Leibniz was a philosopher, was a mathematician. He was a rival to Newton for the invention of the calculus. He was also a diplomat. He attempted to reconcile the Protestants and the Catholics and reunite Europe. He also functioned as a diplomat in the Hanovers, going and taking the English throne. You find him all over the place. There are some philosophers who call him, you know, quote, sort of the smartest person who ever lived. He anticipated symbolic logic. He anticipated computers. And he had a deep disagreement with Newton about the nature of space and time, which is easy to explain. For Newton, before there's any matter, there's space. Space exists absolutely, and particles come in, and it's like a stage which is bare, and the theater is bare, the stage is there, you know, when the play is not on. And then the audience comes in, and the players come on, the actors come on, and they play the play, and their stage directions tell them stage left, stage right, you know, back and so forth. But the stage is always there, no matter what's going on, and its positions on the stage are absolute, are unrelated to the play. And Newton saw space that way, as absolute. And time the same way. There was some time, absolute time. It was just meaningful to say always what time it is in the universe. And for Newton, space was the sensorium of God. Space was God and was God's way of knowing what was in the world, sort of feeling them through their positions in space. Now, Leibniz was also very theological, and he had this big project of reconciling the religions, the Christian religions, with each other. But he had a view of religion that led to a view of space and time in which there was no absolute framework. It was space was only a matter of relationships between things. And without things to have relationships, there would be no space. It was like street theater. Until the actors come and start playing, there is no stage, there is no space. The actors create the space that they play in. And that, we say, is a relational view of space. you know, if I talk about where I am, I can give you an address which is describing where I am really relative to the center of Toronto, to a grid of streets and so forth. So this is all describing position relative in terms of relationships. And Newton believed that behind all of that, there's something else. There's some absolute notion of where one is. And Leibniz denied that. And that was the basis of their disagreement. Scientifically, Newton's view won out at the time. It was much easier to establish a workable physical theory based on Newton's conception than Leibniz's conception. But the debate was kept up from that period into the end of the 19th century by philosophers, by occasional physicists. And Einstein was a student of this literature. And what Einstein did in general relativity was fully realize the Leibnizian view. So general relativity is an entirely relational view of space and time. There is nothing to space and time but a dynamically evolving network of relationships. However, the Newtonian view remains in the rest of physics, which means in quantum physics. In all the other treatments of physics, space and time is treated essentially as Newton did, as an absolute background. And the old language for this debate is the absolute versus the relational view of space and time. The contemporary vocabulary we use, say, in arguments over the future of physics is between background-independent theories, where you specify what is the background of space and time and you fix that background, and then you have things moving in the background, whether they be particles or strings or fields, and background-independent approaches where there is no fixed background and space and time, if it exists at all, is part of a dynamical network of relationships. And this continues to be the center of debate. For example, this is the key issue in the debate between string theorists and essentially everybody else who thinks about the problem of quantum gravity.
Background dependence versus background independence is the key underlying issue in contemporary theoretical physics, Lee Smolin says. String theory has retained the Newtonian framework. For all its fantastic machinery of extra dimensions, he argues, it still assumes a stable framework within which its strings move. He has opted for Einstein's view of things and attempted, along with other colleagues who have adopted this minority position, to integrate quantum mechanics into a relational account of space and time. This has produced a number of new theories, each different but with a certain family resemblance among them all. The variant Lee Smolin works on is called loop quantum gravity, and it pictures space-time as an infinitesimally small gridwork or graph.
The picture of relational space that arose, because it's very Leibnizian, is imagine just a network. So there's just like the internet or the phone network, there are nodes and there are connections between them, and that makes a kind of graph you would draw as a picture hanging in space. And that's a picture of the quantum geometry. Just like atoms, when you look closely, there's this discrete structure. There are the orbitals and so forth. The discrete structure of the quantum geometry of space are these graphs. And that's actually a mathematical theorem. I certainly was not able to prove it, but better people proved it. And so we've understood how to talk about the geometry of space and time and their dynamics completely in quantum mechanical language, and it works.
One of the crucial elements of this theory, as Lee Smolin explained it to me, is that it gives space a discrete structure. Discrete here meaning made of separate and discontinuous bits. This is what it adds, he says, to the theory of relativity, which pictures space-time as smooth and continuous.
When you apply quantum mechanics to matter, then you discover that atoms have discrete structure. And when an atom absorbs some energy, say with a photon coming from the outside, the photon comes in, which is a discrete thing, it's absorbed, and the atom jumps to another energy state, which is a discrete state. So what quantum mechanics implies in many cases is that there's a discreteness in nature. Okay. Now, in general relativity, the geometry of space is something continuous and dynamical. And you can think of like a surface, maybe the surface of a body of water, you know, the geometry of space being like a three-dimensional version of the surface of water. There can be waves through it, it oscillates, it, and so forth. When we apply quantum mechanics to it, we discover that there's a discrete structure. So it turns out that if you measure the volume, if you make a container, a closed container, say this coffee cup with a lid on it, and you ask how much volume is there, in the classical world, you would get a number, which could be a continuous number. Okay. In the loop quantum gravity world, if it's correct, then there's a counting that you actually do. There's actually little pieces of volume. There's the smallest possible volume of a piece of space. And you string them together and you get bigger volumes. Now, in the picture of graphs, the node of a graph is one of these little elemental volumes. So the units involved we can compute, and they're very, very small. There are about 20 elementary lengths, 10 to the 20, so 20 orders of magnitude, one with, you know, 20 zeros, inside of the nucleus of an atom. So these are tiny, tiny scales. Okay. But nonetheless, the theory predicts the magnitude of these elementary pieces of volume and the elementary pieces of area. And so a particle moving smoothly through space, looked at down on the scale, looks something like maybe a chessboard with the chess pieces moving discreetly. And by the way, Einstein also, this is not very well known. John Stachel, the historian, talks about the other Einstein. Einstein, in some letters and writings, did anticipate the structure of space turning out to be discrete in this way. Although he didn't know how to work on it himself. He even says, I don't know the right mathematics to get started on this. But he was so frustrated by his search for unified field theory, which all use continuous mathematics and continuous geometry, that he anticipated this.
The theory of loop quantum gravity can be distinguished from the model which currently dominates theoretical physics, string theory, in a number of ways. One important difference is that the strings of string theory are imagined as moving in a continuous space, a space that lacks the discrete structure that Lee Smolin has been talking about. Another is that loop quantum gravity is a testable theory, whereas string theory, as he'll explain in a moment, is not. And if he and his colleagues are right, then the structure they attribute to space should produce minute variations in the speed at which light travels, an effect physicists call dispersion. And once the predictions of the theory are refined, Lee Smolin says, this effect should be observable.
This is a tiny effect. And it used to be said that you couldn't measure any such effects because you would need an elementary particle accelerator the size of a galaxy or something like that. But it turns out that we have access to experimental apparatuses much huger than a galaxy, which is that we see photons that travel across the observable universe from 10 billion years ago when they were created in big explosions called gamma ray bursts. And these gamma rays are detected roughly one a day in satellites in Earth orbit. And so that creates a laboratory the size of the universe. Okay. And in the propagation, if this expectation is borne out at the right order of magnitude, even without being able to predict the exact numbers, one predicts that the difference between photons, they should have spread out by a time of about a thousandth of a second. Now, that's a small time, but for the modern electronics that goes into the satellites that are being built, that's trivial. I mean, computers operate many, many orders of magnitude faster than that. So this becomes a measurable effect. And the next gamma ray satellite to study these gamma ray bursts, which is called GLAST, is scheduled to launch in November of this year. And over a few years, it may discover such an effect. So there's a handful of such effects which are amplified by long, long travel times across the universe, which amplify these tiny things that we couldn't detect in an experiment on Earth. And so these, if you like, are very small modifications of Einstein's principles of relativity that come from the discrete nature of space and time that loop quantum gravity predicts.
You're listening to Ideas on CBC Radio 1 in Canada, across North America on Sirius Satellite Radio 137, and around the world on cbc.ca. The program is called How to Think About Science, and it's presented by David Cayley.
The theory of loop quantum gravity that Lee Smolin has been laying out here is just one of a number of ongoing efforts to solve a fundamental problem of contemporary theoretical physics, the incompatibility between quantum mechanics and the general theory of relativity. String theory is another such attempt, but in Smolin's view, it has come to exert an unhealthy sway over the entire field. This has happened since 1984, when crucial problems in string theory were solved, and it took off, developing in the process what Smolin calls an almost cult-like atmosphere, as well as a dominant position in many of the most important research institutions. This worries Lee Smolin, first because string theory makes no testable predictions, and second because he thinks it has developed into a form of groupthink that is inhibiting the free and independent spirit that should properly characterize theoretical physics. He makes this argument in his recent book, The Trouble with Physics, and he begins his development of the argument here with an explanation of what string theory is.
String theory is a hypothesis about the unification of all the forces and all the particles in nature. So at the level of description that you can do in string theory, where there is this string moving through space, through a fixed space, or it turns out sometimes it can be a higher dimensional object moving through a higher dimensional space. Okay, and if you imagine it has different overtones of vibration like a guitar string or violin string, and you can arrange it so they correspond to different kinds of elementary particles, then there's a trick. And the trick is, if you want to get the elementary particles to come out looking like our world, you take some of these extra dimensions. So string theory comes along with a package deal where if you buy it, you have to buy that there are six extra dimensions, but you can fold them up into any of an infinity of different geometries. And the strings wiggle at have different modes of vibration, which wiggle at different frequencies, depending on the geometry of these extra dimensions, because they can be running around in these extra dimensions. And by adjusting the choice of the geometry of the extra dimensions, you can get any kind of particles you like, practically speaking. You can make them more massive, less massive, different interactions. So the triumph of string theory, it's a beautiful idea, is that you can capture all of elementary particle physics and the vibrations of these strings. The Achilles heel is that to have a hope of getting elementary particle physics to come out right, you exploit the freedom of choosing the geometry of these extra dimensions. And the problem is that there's infinite freedom.
Let me try and paraphrase and see if I'm understanding you. You have your observed phenomena. To explain them, you make up a story. There's no way of testing whether that's the right story.
Well, usually
you might as well say it's microscopic elves that are generating
reality. There's more structure in string theory than in the theory of elves. But it's a puzzling and disappointing turn of events, because in the original excitement back in 1984, there was a sense one was closing in on something which was rather unique. I mean, at that time, it turned out there were five versions. If you kept the geometry of the 10 dimensionals of space and time that had to be there, if you just kept them completely flat and unadorned, then there were only five versions. And there was a belief that maybe these are the only five ways a world can be. But if you take the geometry of the background, you see how the fact that the theory is defined on a background is its Achilles heel, because the fact that you can choose the background arbitrarily to be any of an infinite number of backgrounds means that the theory is actually an infinite number of different theories. And so far as we know, there's not a consequence for experiment. There's nobody's been able to extract anything that is what we call falsifiable. That is, if it's not seen, then the theory is wrong. And this has just never happened before in the history of physics. A remarkable thing, I mean, as radical as general relativity was, even before Einstein had it in final form, he knew what the key experiments were, he knew the data, he knew what he would have to match. There's things that Newtonian physics didn't get right. Then he had several predictions that could be done with the technology of the time within a few years, 2 years, 3 years. So the same thing with special relativity, same thing with quantum mechanics, same thing in every successful instance in the history of physics. The experimental check comes right away. There's always the contact with nature. It's very easy to make mathematical structures, to invent mathematical games that make no contact with reality. But a situation where some thousand more, you know, very gifted, very highly placed people in the, you know, most elite places in the world passionately believe in something and have worked on it passionately for two decades without a hint of how to test it experimentally, that's unlike anything that's ever happened before in the history of physics.
Lee Smolin regarded string theory, when it first appeared, as a promising conjecture, and some of his own ideas were formed in his attempt to understand it. But somehow, he says, this conjecture has turned into an academic industry, which monopolizes resources and marginalizes alternative approaches. In his book, he offers several explanations as to why this has happened. One is that string theory's weakness, its elasticity, its being, as Smolin says, an infinite number of theories, is at the same time its strength. Making no testable predictions, it can never be disproved. Another is that the pragmatic turn in physics has produced problem solvers, when what was needed was philosophers. And finally, he argues, the hegemony of string theory has been fostered by the way science is now organized and funded.
Because there are few funding bodies and many universities, there's a uniformization of judgment. That is, a university or university department can't make judgments on its own. They rely in a way more and more seriously, and more seriously than in the past, in the judgments of panels at funding bodies, in the judgments of what are called visiting committees, who are eminent scientists from the most, you know, prestigious universities who come and visit them and tell them what fields they should be working in. And so there's much more of a kind of steering of directions by a kind of consensus, which is generated nationally and internationally, which is, you know, more dominant in the larger countries like the United States, and the smaller countries like, say, Canada or Holland, less so because they are smaller. So that's the first thing. Another thing that happened is the universities expanded exponentially between the 1940s and the 1970s. And in this period, another change was happening, which is a lot of government funding from the various federal governments came in and drove the growth of especially science. And during that period, it wasn't difficult to get an academic job. So there was a lot of decentralization. You got a PhD. I know people from that period, most of whom are now retired, who never applied for a job. They never had any career anxiety. Now, if you wanted to be a professor, you know, at McGill or Harvard or whatever, there was competition for it. But it wasn't hard to find a place for yourself somewhere. So there was a kind of decentralization. And because of that decentralization, there was, as there should be in the academic world, a variety of viewpoints, of approaches to any problem. Then all of a sudden, the expansion stopped in 1972, and I think the date is even pretty precisely known. And there was this cadre of young PhDs who had been growing and growing and growing, and they all just like went over a cliff. All of a sudden, there were no academic physicians. And I think this happened, this certainly hit science very hard. I think it hit all fields to some extent. And all of a sudden, there went the very quick transition to a atmosphere of scarcity in which many more PhDs were being trained than could fit. And in that atmosphere of scarcity, there became a lot of professionalization and competition among the universities to keep the funding and to acquire funding by hiring faculty who would do the best job of bringing funding to the universities. So a thing that happened, I think, is that there's a variety of styles of good scientists as well as good anything. However, now that there was a lot of competition, that there was a professionalization, there became a paradigm of what's a good scientist. Because now you had to make difficult judgments, compare people, the funding bodies had to, you know, reject most of the applications and so forth. And the paradigm that got established is that a good scientist is a very clever problem solver. So, and to be a very clever problem solver implies you're working in what Kuhn called a paradigm, where there's a well-defined theoretical basis, a well-defined experimental practice, a well-defined set of techniques, and you're incrementally improving the techniques within a well-defined domain. And that's what Kuhn called normal science. A term for that I like that comes from Eric Weinstein, who's a mathematician and economist, is that such people are hill climbers. This is sort of imagining the problems in science as hills. You're trying to find a theory, and a good theory is a hill of a certain height. The right theory is a mountain somewhere over there. Everything is shrouded in fog, and there are people who are good hill climbers. You put them down on the side of a hill, and they'll go up. And basically, if you define who you want to hire as who climbs the hill the fastest, given that the hill is well-defined, you can do that. However, then you end up with a bunch of communities of people stuck on the top of hills, yelling at each other because all they know is the technology involved in their hill, in climbing their hill, insulting each other from hilltop to hilltop when the real thing is some mountain shrouded in fog way over there. To get to the mountain, you need people who are what Eric Weinstein calls valley crossers, these crazy people who go down when everybody else is competing to go up the fastest because they don't like crowds or they have their own idea or they smell something which maybe is a valley or a forest over there and they go off on their own. And of course, many of them get lost, but there are people with incredible talent of somehow finding new mountains. You put them down on the side of a hill and they'll go down, but they'll end up higher than everybody else somewhere else a few years later. And those people, you know, Watson and Crick were such people. I mean, they wandered into molecular biology. You know, they were physicists. They had no training. They didn't know anything. They had never worked with the techniques involved. And they just started playing, you know, putting these things together. And they, you know, they did it. Otherwise, they would have been total failures. Einstein was such a person. That's why he had trouble getting an academic job. Bohr was such a person. He was two-thirds a philosopher who had strange ways of talking. And my hypothesis is that not enough thought has been given to making sure that there's space for the valley crossers or for the rebels. And the thing that's poignant is that there aren't that many such people. What it would take to support all of them is not very expensive. Because, you know, maybe in fundamental physics there are 50 people like this. Maybe that's too many. Maybe in biology there are a few hundred people like this, which compares, you know, around the world, who have trouble getting their laboratory started. You know, and if I think it's bad in physics, I mean, the success rate for an assistant professor of biology getting a first grant from the NIH in the United States is like 12%. That used to be much higher. Okay. So first of all, no wonder the successful ones tend to go in with the big, already established research programs. And no wonder the departments who need their faculty to have funding to make their balance sheets work go for the people who are following the big established directions. Now, I don't have the knowledge to say, and therefore progress in medical science is much slower than it would be. But what I think I believe is that progress in fundamental physics is much slower than it should be, because scientific ideas, scientific research programs are like new firms, and one has, you know, venture capital, and one would like the funding bodies to think like venture capitalists. These are investments, and if you talk to venture capitalists, they understand that if you want to keep the front of technology moving, most of the things that you invest in will fail. For every Microsoft, for every successful biotech startup, there are 20 that fail. But there's no choice. That's what you have to do. If you only keep putting money into Microsoft now, the progress of technology would stop. You have to keep funding the startups, and you have to accept that to get a high rate of progress and also to get a high rate of return, you have to accept a high risk ratio. And string theory is a high risk, high payoff thing. And in some sense, the message, you know, of this part of my book is that's great, okay? But, you know, so is quantum causal history, so is causal sets, so is twister theory, so is Gerard Atoff's idea, so is Alain Cohn's non-commutative geometry. So one should have a portfolio of these things.
All these things you have named are...
our approaches to quantum gravity.
Which have a much lower profile.
Yes.
And much less support.
Yes.
Than string theory.
Yes.
And that's why most people listening to us will never have heard of any of them.
Yes. And most of them are, you know, half a dozen, 20 people around the world. And that's about right. You know, one of the things, when you start to get thousands of people working on something, almost all of them are redundant when it's a new speculative idea. And many of those young people, you know, complain about that. Many of the young string theorists are highly gifted people who believe in what they're doing, who know what they're doing, and know why they're doing it. But one still hears from them, you know, in the corners, in the, you know, so to speak, in the quiet moments, complaints that their research program is too directed, that there's too much faddishness. If there's some problem which is unsolved for 3 years, then the support to work on it gets dropped. People who continue working on it don't get faculty positions, don't get invited to the key spots at conferences which identify who the young stars are, and therefore the problems don't get solved. So even within string theory, there's my advice is to have a much more venture capital point of view. Support things, don't support anything too much.
The predominance of string theory in the strongholds of theoretical physics is a product, Lee Smolin believes, of two great forces. The pragmatic turn in American physics, which marginalized philosophical concern, and the current organization of the academy, which fosters conformism and monoculture. His prescription calls for a revival of the intellectual independence and philosophical breadth that he thinks characterized early 20th century physics. Physicists, until well into the 19th century, were still called natural philosophers, and Smolin, in a sense, is arguing that that remains their proper vocation. He also thinks that physics and physicists need to engage with other elements of culture. Natural science, for him, is part of culture and ought to be exchanging ideas with the arts, with the social sciences, and with the humanities. His books, The Life of the Cosmos, Three Roads to Quantum Gravity, and The Trouble with Physics, which we've been discussing, are attempts to situate science at what he calls the front of contemporary culture. And the conversation that he wants to foster is going on, he says, finally, though it remains limited by a narrowness that he thinks is still all too prevalent.
There are many scientists, and I assume it must be the same in other fields, there are many scientists in my field who know very little outside their field of science and know nothing of the history or literature of their field going back before the beginning of their career. And that is unfortunate, and I think that you can have some people like that because we need a variety of people, but too many people like that impedes progress because they get stuck in ruts, they get stuck at the top of hills, they can't get off. But there is the conversation that I'm talking about, and what those of us in it seek is somehow to be establishing a conversation across the front of culture. And it's not my place to say it because I'm involved in this, but this gives me the impression that science is part of sort of the front of culture as culture evolves and culture progresses. And those of us who are at the front, scientists, artists, social theorists, architects, writers, and so forth, have a lot to say to each other that maybe we lose out with the over-specialization and departmentalization. And there are venues for that conversation. Some of them are conferences, some of them are friendships, some of them are cities. So, I mean, a city is a venue for a conversation. That's what they're for. And, you know, as a New Yorker, you know, who moved to Toronto, I'm pretty excited about Toronto, as that is the people I meet here, you know, from theater, films, music, writers, people in technology, you know, people in politics here. I mean, Toronto is, say, more like New York than it is like London and Paris. That is, it's a more open, accessible city. You could be in Paris, you know, forever and never meet anybody who does anything different than you. Whereas in New York, you know, once you're somehow in New York, you're continually meeting people who do something interesting other than what you do. And I'm finding that Toronto is like that as well. So I think I'm in a very lucky position because I've been fortunate to be able to write books as part of this community. And through the writing of the books, the circle of the people that I'm fortunate to have as friends or that I communicate with is much, much wider as a result of writing the books. And it's been very, very well worth it. It's certainly worth every hour of time and agony that went into it, of which I'm sure you appreciate is considerable.
Lee Smolin, recorded at his home in Toronto. He's a member of the faculty of the Perimeter Institute at the University of Waterloo and the author of The Trouble with Physics. How to Think About Science will conclude next week at this time with a conversation with British philosopher Nicholas Maxwell, the author of From Knowledge to Wisdom.
On Ideas, you've listened to How to Think About Science, produced and presented by David Cayley, with the assistance of Bernie Lucht, Dave Field, and Liz Nagy. A printed transcript of the series will be available after its completion. For information about the podcast of these programs, or to order a transcript or audio copies, please go to our website at cbc.ca/ideas. You'll also find sound files of the programs posted there. The executive producer of Ideas is Bernie Lucht. I'm Paul Kennedy. Please stay tuned now to CBC Radio 1 and to Sirius Satellite Radio for the hourly news.